Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm really impressed by the quantity of people that are here. This is a great subject, and maybe I'll be able to speak more on this at other conventions and maybe narrow in on different parts of the Knights Templar and the Crusades. My name's Ilanka Dunnan, and I am not a professor. However, I am a Crusades hobbyist. I love reading books about the Crusades. Also, I live in St. Louis, which has a Crusades meetings of Crusades historians every week. St. Louis University is a big center of Crusades research in the United States. And I have done some writing on the Knights Templar and on Crusades, especially on Wikipedia. One of my hobbies is going through the articles and trying to make them more on the accuracy side and not so much on the urban legends and the mythology side. And as it's actually good, because as I'm doing that kind of a research, someone will come in and will add something bizarre. And, you know, like the Mongols conquering Jerusalem with Jacques de Molay in charge of one of their divisions. And I'm like, that didn't happen. And then I'll go research and I'll have to find out not only what the truth is, but where did the legend come from? And so that's what my talk is going to be about actually who the Knights Templar were. They were a wonderful organization, very active for about 200 years during the Crusades. And I'll also be talking about some of the legends and some of the places that the legends came from, such as Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code. So, all right. So the Knights Templar, I'll be covering kind of in order here, kind of how the Knights Templar started and then what their organization did for a couple hundred years, how they fell. That's really the most famous part of them because of the dramatic arrests all on that October 13th, 1307. Last year, by the way, was the 700-year anniversary of those arrests. I was actually trying to give this talk last year, couldn't get a slot, so I figured, okay, I'll give the talk for the 701st anniversary of the arrests. But yeah, anyone who saw me last year, I was constant. Every time I was drinking, I was going, to the Knights Templar! Okay, yeah. All right, so the Knights Templar were warrior monks. They founded around 1118 or 1119. There's kind of differences depending on which historian you talk to, and ended fairly dramatically around 1312. They were involved in every aspect of society. They owned huge tracts of land. They owned businesses. They had their own fleet. There were thousands of members. There were thousands of buildings dotted all around Europe and the Holy Land. And they were really regarded as the world's first multinational corporation. They really innovated a lot of techniques that were the origin of what we see as today's modern banking. They originated what we call checking systems, traveler's checks. And I'll be going over some of that. These are some of the, this is on the right-hand side, we see sort of what is today Israel and Lebanon and Syria, and then we have the island of Cyprus. Let me just, my mouse. So there's Cyprus. Okay, so it was founded by Hugh de Payon. Hugh de Payon came from northern France in this area. I'll be talking about that a little bit later. And he was a veteran of the First Crusade. First Crusade came in about 1099. The Pope called him and wanted people to go and reconquer Jerusalem for Christianity, and he was one of the many knights that went down there. And then after Jerusalem was captured, a lot of pilgrims came from Europe, and they wanted to go to Jerusalem to see the holy places that they read about and heard about in the Bible. But the area was definitely not secure. And what would happen is that the pilgrims would come into a port called Jaffa, and then they'd try to go overland, because Jerusalem is not a coastal city, it's an inland city. And that trip from the coast into Jerusalem was incredibly dangerous, because there were still Muslim troops around, there were a lot of bandits around kind of attacking the pilgrims. And pilgrims were just, it wasn't just that they were being mugged, they were being slaughtered, sometimes hundreds at a time. It was a very, very dangerous journey. And so Hugh de Payon wanted to do something about this, and so he suggested the formation of a new monastic order that would be involved with some knights from the First Crusade that would be to protect these pilgrims as they went back and forth from Jaffa to Jerusalem. And so he got six or seven other knights also from this northern France area, and they went to the new Christian king of Jerusalem, Baldwin II, and they said, hey, can we set up this order? And King Baldwin said, yeah, sounds like a great idea. And he gave them quarters on part of the Temple Mount. So this is Jerusalem during the Crusades, and the Temple Mount is a very, very famous area. It's a prime piece of real estate in Jerusalem. This is a dome that was built by the Muslims at one point when they were in control of Jerusalem. Jerusalem has obviously been going back and forth through different hands over the years. The Temple Mount, many of you probably already know this, but just kind of as a summary, is important to multiple faiths. And as a really quick overview, Christians believe that it was the location of the Temple of Solomon, where if you've heard that story about Jesus going to the temple and chasing away the money changers, that was on the Temple Mount. The story about Abraham being instructed to sacrifice his son on a mountain, that was also on the Temple Mount. Muslims also believe that it's a holy area. There's something called the Isra and Miraj, and if I'm massacring the pronunciation of that, I apologize, but it's called the night journey, which is a big tradition in the Muslim faith. They believe that Muhammad was resting in Mecca in about the 7th century, and that they disagree on whether it was a dream or whether it was an actual journey, but the tradition goes that a magical creature came to him, a burak, which is sort of like a centaur or a Pegasus kind of creature. It's a winged mount with a human face. And that Muhammad mounted the burak and was transported from Mecca, which is in southwestern Saudi Arabia, all the way to possibly Jerusalem. He just said to the farthest mosque. And they didn't specifically say Jerusalem, but tradition says that it was in Jerusalem, even though there were no mosques in Jerusalem at that time. And supposedly the burak and Muhammad arrived on the Temple Mount, where Muhammad got off the burak and prayed, and then he got back on the burak and then ascended into heaven, where he went through the various circles of heaven and he met Allah, he met God. And God instructed Muhammad to go back to earth and tell everyone to pray 500 times a day. And Muhammad, on his way back down, one of the other prophets stopped and said, 500, they'll never go for it. Go back to God. Ask him to make it a lower number. So Muhammad went back up to God and negotiated back and forth, and they kind of negotiated the number down to 5 times a day. And then Muhammad came back to earth, burak back over to Mecca, and then that's where he started communicating to everyone, saying, I spoke to God, God said we should pray 5 times a day. So it's the origin of one of the pillars of the Islamic faith, and they believe that it was from that Temple Mount that Muhammad went up. And so the Dome of the Rock that you see is supposedly from the rock, which is from there Muhammad went up into heaven. So that's where that story goes. All right. So the Temple Mount is actually several structures. So here's the dome, and under here is the rock that we were talking about. Then over here there's another mosque, and this is called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which means the farthest mosque. So when the Muslims at one point, when they recaptured Jerusalem, they decided that this must be the spot where Muhammad was, and so they decided to build a mosque, and they called it the farthest mosque. And so some Muslims today believe that Al-Aqsa Mosque was the mosque that Muhammad went to, when in actuality there were no mosques here at all at the time. But it all gets kind of muddled, and that's going to tie into what I'm talking about with the Knights Templar. By the way, if you've heard of the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, and that's here where people go and they pray, because again they believe that this is one of the remnants of the Temple of Solomon. So when the Templars decided that they wanted to form their order, King Baldwin said, okay, you can set up shop here. And he gave them quarters here. This is where they lived. This is where they kept their horses. And they named the monastic order after this area. So it was the Temple Mount, Solomon's Temple. So Templar Knights, the Knights of the Temple. And that's where the name came from. And this is another picture of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So they were very poor at the time, and if you have seen the symbol of the Knights Templar, it shows two knights riding on a single horse to emphasize how impoverished that they were, and they really had to rely on donations to survive. However, they had a very, very powerful patron, Bernard, now Saint Bernard de Clairvaux, and he wrote on their behalf, and he spoke very, very persuasively on the behalf of the Templars, because it was very controversial at the time to have a monk who was also a warrior, and Christianity hadn't really heard about that before. Monks were supposed to be very peaceful people, and here Hugh de Payon was saying, well, yes, but we'll have knights who are also monks, and so there was a lot of criticism. Many people didn't like the idea, but Saint Bernard said, no, this is a great idea, and he said, a Templar knight is truly a fearless knight and secure on every side, for his soul is protected by the armor of faith, just as his body is protected by the armor of steel. He is thus doubly armed and need fear neither demons nor men. That was from a very famous track called, I'm going to butcher the Latin, De Laude Novae Militiae, in praise of the new knighthood. So at the Council of Troyes, which was a gathering, sort of like we have Dragon Con, and they had conventions where all the religious folks went together. Only we do it for a weekend, and they would like do it for like 2 years, because they'd say, okay, well, you know, Joe arrived in March, and Jack, he's not going to be here till August. Just kind of keep yourself busy until he arrives. But so they had the Council of Troyes in 1129, and they talked about many things. And one of the things that they spoke about, especially because St. Bernard was there speaking very persuasively, is they decided to formally recognize this order, this new order of warrior monks. And once they had the official seal from the Council of Troyes, suddenly that they were official, and they were like the number one charity. Anyone who wanted to donate money to the Crusades was donating money to the Knights Templar. That was the best way to get funds, and so they donated money, they donated land, they donated their sons, saying, here, become a knight, go join the Templars. And so the organization started growing very, very rapidly, because they had all of these funds just pouring in. And they had a very nice structure that was made for them. St. Bernard had been a member of the Cistercian orders, and this was before the organization of the Templars. And he'd set up a set of rules. It wasn't just, okay, we're going to have a monastic order. No, he had specific things saying, what were they supposed to wear? When were they supposed to eat? How were they supposed to pray? What kind of contact could they have with the outside world? And so St. Bernard and Hugh de Payon got together, and they made this rule of a series of rules called the Rule. For the Templars as well. They had to wear white robes all the time. They couldn't take them off, not even to eat or anything. They had to wear these robes all the time. Once they were in the order, they could have no contact with women, not even members of their own family. They were supposed to be completely separate, completely pure. They could only eat meat, I think, like 3 times a week. So each one of these things was very specifically prescribed for them. Okay, and then they also had a lot of support from the Pope, Pope Innocent II. There was something called a papal bull, which was a directive from the papacy. And in 1139, the papal bull, Omni Datus Optimum, we name them by like the first few words that are in the bull, and they were this document with this formal seal on it. And in 1139, he said this bull, and in it it said Templars were exempt from all local laws. In other words, if they were going through all these different countries in Europe, they didn't have to like stop at each border and pay taxes and do this. No, the Pope said that they could just pass freely through all borders. So any Templar going from England down to the Holy Land, straight through. They didn't have to pay taxes. They answered only to the Pope, which again made them very, very powerful. And some of this also was kind of planting the seeds for later on. Some other nobles were getting not so happy that they had this basic army that could kind of pass freely through all borders, and they were all very well trained, and this started making some nobles kind of nervous that the Templars were going through. So some more about the organization of the Templars. They had 3 basic divisions. They had the knights, and these had to be of knightly descent. They had to be of noble birth. And that's why, again, as I was saying, people were donating land and money and their sons to the order. And once someone joined the order, they had to swear vows of chastity and piety and poverty, and they had to donate all of their belongings to the order, which again made the order even wealthier. And so there was the knights of knightly descent, and then those who were lower born were the sergeants, the warriors, and the craftsmen, and then there was a third version, which was the clergy, who attended to the spiritual needs of the knights. Right. The warriors, with all of this funding coming in, they were the best armament of the day. They had armament, their horses had armament, they were superbly trained, best kind of weaponry, and they were fearless. They were basically like suicide charges. And one effective tactic that would happen is if there was a battle, the Templars would be in the front of the Christian forces, and there would be a line of these Templar war horses, big war horses, heavily armed, and they would just charge full out at the opposing side. And imagine if you're on the opposing side and you're seeing these huge horses, all this armament coming straight at you. Often it would work, and then people would scatter. And that way the Templars would get that wedge in and be able to divide the opposing side, and that would give the Christian side an edge in the battle. Also, they were superb warriors in that they would not stop fighting. They were forbidden to leave the battlefield unless their flag had fallen. And even if their flag did fall, they were supposed to look to see if one of the, there were a couple other Christian orders, such as the Knights of the Hospital and the Teutonic Knights. So if the Templar flag fell, then the Templars would look to see, was the hospital flag still up, or was the Teutonic flag still up? And then they would go and fight on those sides. And often they would just fight to the death. And the Muslims actually had a lot of respect for the Templars, simply because they were such superb warriors, and that they believed strongly in what they were doing. So there were different regions where the Templars were, and each region would have its own master, and then there was one Grand Master over the entire organization. This was a lifetime appointment, though considering that the Grand Masters were also warriors, this was often a very short appointment. Many Grand Masters did die, and then they'd have to pick another one. This was also one of the flaws in the order, though, is that the Grand Master, because they were in charge of everything, they were in charge of the military side of it, also of the administrative side of it, and it was very difficult to find a Grand Master who could do it all, and many of them couldn't do it all, and so that started causing some problems as well. There would be a Grand Master who was good at being a leader of the organization, but in terms of being a battle tactician, he was awful. And then the Templars would lose a battle, and that would cause other problems. Then, of course, there was the one of the rules was the initiation ceremony, which was held in secret, and they had to give these vows of four vows: chastity, piety, poverty, and obedience. This is one of the places where the initiation ceremony took place. This is in London. This is the Temple Church, and one of the signifying factors of Templar architectures, they tended to build these round buildings. And this was after some of the architecture that they saw in Jerusalem. And the Templars were just hugely influential. Even today, pretty much anywhere you go in London or around England, anything that you see temple, like the Temple Tube Station or the Temple Bar Gateway, that's all named after the Templars. That's where the name came from. So they originated the idea of checking these letters of credit, because as they were protecting the pilgrims that were going from the coastline of Jaffa into Jerusalem, and they also started extending this to protecting the pilgrims who were like leaving from England or France and going down to Jerusalem. And one way they did is that they realized that pilgrims, as they were traveling, were being attacked because you didn't have credit cards. You had to carry your wealth with you if you wanted to buy food or you wanted to pay an innkeeper. So the Templars came up with these a way of a letter of credit. So before you would leave England or France or wherever, you would deposit all of your belongings with a Templar bank, and they would give you a letter saying what you had, sort of like a letter of credit. And then you would just carry that letter of credit with you down to Jerusalem, and then there you could turn it in and you could say, here's the money that I want. And so this made the pilgrims traveling much lighter and also made them not as tempting targets for the thieves. Now, there is some dispute about the letter. There are some historians who say that these were encrypted letters, and others who say, no, it was just kind of regular writing, not that many people were literate at the time. And I got interested in that because one of my other things is codes and secret codes, and so I was kind of digging in, what kind of code? And I'm not so sure that part's true. There was evidently just two people who said it was encrypted, but I haven't been able to really get to the origin of that. But so the Templars, when people deposited goods, another thing that people would do is if some people could be Templars for a short period of time. Someone might say, I want to be a Templar I'm of noble birth, I want to fight for the Templars for 5 years, and then I'm going to go back to secular life. And so someone might donate all of their goods to the Templars for a period of time, and then they'd go off and they'd fight in Jerusalem, and then they'd come back after 5 years. So the Templars and other people would deposit just everything they had, say if they were just traveling across the country, across the continent, because the Templars, they were very honest. They're very, very few stories I've heard of corruption, and they would guard the wealth, also for like retirement assets. If somebody was like saving money, saving that nest egg, and they didn't have banks or anything, they'd deposit it with the Templars, and then people would just deposit a little more, and then they'd collect it when they wanted to retire. So the Templars were not just guarding money, they were running the farms and the vineyards. Or someone might say, can you watch my four ships for me and make sure that they go back and forth and do all that? And the Templars were managing these things. So many of the workers in Europe were working for organizations that were being run by the Templars. They were just this huge multinational corporation all through Europe and the Holy Land. So these are some of the battles that they fought in. When the Christians first captured Jerusalem, part of the reason they were able to do it is because the Muslims were very fragmented at the time, and they weren't able to really put together a solid defense. But then other Muslim leaders, such as Saladin, came in and really started putting the Muslim forces back together, and they had a much more unified military structure. And the Muslims did some serious ass kicking. They went through like the battle of the Horns of Hattin. I think I have a picture of this. This was really a turning point in the Crusades, where the Muslims became dominant over the Christians. And part of the problem here was because the Christian forces at the time were being run by the Templar Grand Master, who was not a good tactician. He made some mistakes. He had to decide, okay, the Christian force is arriving, where are we going to camp? Should we camp near water, or should we go a little bit further towards the battlefield? And he made a mistake of saying, let's go a little further towards the battlefield. So they didn't have easy access to water. The Muslims knew this the next day, and one of the tactics that the Muslims used is they lit a bunch of fires and made a lot of smoke going towards the Christian forces. So here the Christian forces are tired. They didn't have access to water. They have smoke coming at them, horrible heat coming down, and it just completely weakened the Christian forces, and the Muslims just routed them. Serious victory. And then it was that same year that the Muslims were able to recapture Jerusalem as well. So the Templars, who had their headquarters down here in Jerusalem, after Jerusalem was captured, they moved their headquarters north here to the city of Acre, which was on the coast. And they had some serious fortifications here, and they held that for the next 100 years. But bit by bit, the Muslims were getting more and more organized, and they took this, and eventually moved forward, and eventually Acre fell as well in 1291. And so then the Templars moved their headquarters north again. I think it was up around here, up around Tortosa, and then they got kicked out of Tortosa as well, and then they moved their headquarters off to Cyprus. And at one point they were trying to come back to a little island here called the Island of Ruad, Arwad Island, and then they tried to get a foothold back on the Holy Land, and that didn't work either. And I think they lost that in like 1302 or 1303, and then with the loss of that, all the Christians had gotten kicked off the continent by then. So this was around 1300. So as these losing battles were being fought, Europe got less and less excited at the idea of supporting the Templars and supporting the Crusades, because it wasn't as much fun. It was a losing battle. And so the critics started increasing in volume over the people that were supporting the Templars. So King Philip was one of the critics. Philip IV, Philip the Fair. And along with other nobles, the Templars, like I said, had been these banks and would often make loans. And King Philip was one of the people that the Templars were making loans to. And he'd been trying to do this because he was fighting with the English, and he had different things going on. And he was hugely in debt to the order. And Pope Clement V at the time, he was also trying to figure out what to do with the Templars. And there were these different military orders, and he was saying, okay, we have the Knights Templar and the Knights of the Hospital. They used to be fighting for the Crusades. They're not fighting for the Crusades anymore. What are we going to do with them? Maybe we can join the two orders and, you know, try and do some consolidation here. So he invited, he wrote to both the orders and said, you want to join? And they said, no. And and then he wrote back to them and said, come here, let's all talk about this. And the Grand Master at the time, Jacques de Molay of the Templars, went to talk to the Pope, and the Grand Master of the Knights Hospital was delayed a few months. As I said, they had these long travel times. So while de Molay and the Pope were talking, one of the things that they spoke about was how there had been some charges of corruption by a Templar, an ousted knight, who had made some accusations at the Order of the Templars. And the accusations were false, but they were trying to figure out what to do about them. And so the Pope wrote to King Philip saying, oh, the Templars have been falsely charged with this stuff, can you help? And King Philip looked at these charges and went, I owe a lot of money to the Templars. And so King Philip decided to say, no, the charges are true. And he started to pressure the Pope to disband the Order of the Knights Templar, and that way King Philip wouldn't owe them any more money. And this went back and forth for a while, but King Philip, I mean, at one point he had like troops around the papal buildings saying, disband the Templars or I'm going to take over. And King Philip had done this with previous popes. There'd been a previous, I think it was Boniface VII, I think, where King Philip had been trying to pressure the Pope to do something. The Pope had said no, and King Philip had him kidnapped. had the Pope kidnapped. The people rose up and got the Pope back, but it was an elderly Pope, and then that Pope died a couple months later. And so then a new Pope was put in. That was and then King Philip said, okay, do this, and the Pope said no, and King Philip sent someone to poison the Pope. And so that Pope died. And then the cardinals got together and said, okay, what are we going to do? Who are we going to elect next time? And they were in conclave for a year, trying to figure out what to do. And they finally elected Pope Clement V, who was a Frenchman, and he had been a childhood friend of Philip. Okay. And Pope Clement also did something where he moved the papacy. He moved it from Italy to France, to Avignon. So if you've ever heard of something called like the Avignon papacy, that was because France was really trying to control the church at that time. So, I mean, Pope Clement, he wasn't entirely a puppet of King Philip, but he was pressured intensely by Philip. And eventually Pope Clement issued this another bull, Pastoralis Praemente, and he said, arrest all the Templars in Europe and seize their assets. Oh, I skipped a step. This was in November. In October 13th, right before that, King Philip had sent out orders that all of the Templars in France were to be arrested. And it was a very dramatic dawn raid. It was done in secrecy. And orders went to all across France, and everything was launched on the same morning all across France, arrest all the Templars. And they arrested a few hundred, and what King Philip was trying to do was to arrest, and he gave orders to arrest the Templars and get their stuff, because he wanted to get their resources, their finances, and put it into the French treasury. And so it was part of that Pope Clement issued his bull to the other European monarchs, saying, arrest the Templars and seize their assets. And most of the other European monarchs said, what the heck are you talking about? And they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't arrest the Templars because they realized that this was all a bunch of trumped-up charges. So it was a huge scandal. But eventually the Pope kept pressuring and Philip kept pressuring, and in March 1312 the Pope issued a Vox in Excelsia, the voice saying, disband the Templars, the order shall be no more. But he also a couple months later did this ad providam saying all their assets go not to France but go to the Knights Hospital. So that was one kind of way that he was rebelling against King Philip. But these were the Templars that were arrested by King Philip. The other European leaders didn't go along with it. They were horrified. But there were trials. In France, King Philip had the Templars arrested and tortured and extracted forced confessions out of them. As we all know, if you torture someone, they're going to say whatever the heck you want them to say. And they were being charged with things such as, you know, sodomy and blasphemy and spitting on the cross, which were actually, these charges were the exact same charges that when King Philip had earlier kidnapped that other pope, he'd also charged that pope with sodomy and blasphemy and spitting on the cross. So it was like this copy-pasted boilerplate. The exact same charges were being issued. So eventually some of the Templars, the Pope was not happy about these forced confessions and was trying to say, let's give them a formal trial. Let's give them a formal trial. And some of the Templars were educated men and they had legal experience to protect themselves. But King Philip wouldn't have that. And so he declared several hundred of them guilty of heresy and had them burned at the stake right there so that they would not be able to protect themselves in the trials. It was really gruesome what he was doing. So Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master, he also had confessed under torture, but eventually he was in prison for a while, and then he recanted his confession. He said, no, what I said wasn't true, the Templars, I'm an honorable man. And Philip kept pressuring him, and Jacques de Molay would not recant his confession. And so King Philip had him burned at the stake as well, along both Jacques de Molay and his associate Geoffrey de Charnay. And they were burned at the stake in Paris on an island in the Seine. According to legend, Jacques de Molay asked to be tied in such a way that he was facing the Notre Dame Cathedral with his hands tied together in prayer. And also, according to legend, he called out from the flames that both King Philip and Pope Clement would soon meet him before God. And both King Philip and Pope Clement died that very same year, even though Clement was a little older, but Philip was a fairly young man. I think one died in a hunting accident, and I forget how the other one died. But Philip's sons also all met gruesome ends. And in France, there's actually a mini-series called the Accursed Kings, because Philip's entire line died out. So what happened to the remaining Templars? Well, here's where a lot of legends kick in. Oh, you know, they were this group and they sailed to America or they sailed to Scotland. Well, in reality, it's sort of like if you're working for a multinational corporation and the corporation shuts down, what do? You go work for some other company. And that's basically what the Templars did as well. In fact, in Portugal, the Order of the Knights Templar, they just changed their name, saying, okay, we're not Templars anymore. Now we're the Order of Christ. But it was the exact same organization. And others, they were absorbed into the Knights Hospital. Some of them returned to secular life. Some of them were just pensioned off. This is in Portugal. It's now a UNESCO World Heritage Site. That was one of the Templar buildings. Again, you see the round architecture. So let's go into some of the fiction. This is one of the images that's often associated with the Templars. And it's horrible. I actually saw a National Geographic documentary about the Templars where they were doing reenactments and they showed the Templars worshiping this little Baphomet image. No, this Baphomet image wasn't even drawn until the 19th century. Okay? And the Templars, they were disbanded in the 1300s. It was one of the charges in King Philip's trials that the Templars were worshipping some sort of an image. And there was this word Baphomet, that shows up in the trial transcripts. And people have looked at this Baphomet and assumed that it means some sort of a demon. In actuality, if you talk to real historians, they say, no, it was probably a misspelling. It was probably Muhammad. I mean, the Templars were in these Muslim countries and they were battling. Often the Templars and the Muslims had very good relations because they had a lot of respect for each other, but then they'd have to go on the battlefield and fight, and then off the battlefield again they would have respect for each other. And so the name Baphomet, in the 19th century there was this artist, Eliphas Levi, who drew this image of Baphomet, and then that image has now carried forward today and people associate it with the Templars, but no, it's all after the fact stuff. Another legend, people say that, I hear this all the time, I bring up Templars, they say, oh, did you know that the Templars are the origin of the Friday the 13th legend? I'm like, no. Friday the 13th did not even really come into being until around 1900. And you can go and you can look at books of folklore and mythology and legends and dictionaries from the 1800s, and you look up and you look up Friday and it'll say Friday, unlucky day. And you look up 13, it'll say 13, unlucky number. You look up Friday the 13th, nothing, nada. It just wasn't an association. Friday, yes. 13, yes. Friday the 13th, no. However, around 1900, there was a politician who did something really stupid on a Friday the 13th. And so some newspapers started making fun of him. And they wrote an article saying, doing something on Friday the 13th, how stupid can you be? And so Friday the 13th. And it was a meme. It was something that picked up. And then Friday the 13th started picking up steam on its own. Dan Brown, Da Vinci Code, started talking about Friday the 13th, but no, Friday the 13th, nothing to do with the Templars. Holy Grail, a really fascinating story. I generally, in one word, this was medieval fan fiction. That's the best way that I can describe it. It was a story that was written in 1180. Interestingly enough, it was written by Chrétien de Troyes, and remember we had that Council of Troyes. So this is all kind of coming out of that same area of northern France. You see, I got a little map of France here coming the same area. But Chrétien de Troyes wrote this story, Le Conte du Graal, the story of the Graal. And it was about, as I recall, it was about Galahad and how he was seeking something, and at one point he saw this beautiful girl walk through carrying this grail. And the story became, it was like a bestseller in Europe at the time. And it was going through and people were going, what is the grail? What is the grail? I want to know more about the grail. And so other people started writing stories about the grail. And then they started expanding on it. Is the grail, well, maybe it's the cup that Jesus drank from. And where is the grail? Well, the Templars guard everything. The Templars must have it. And so then it started getting associated with the Templars. And the story just kept growing and growing and growing. And you can look at stories like in Parzival, there's this thing about Templars guarding the Grail Kingdom. And it was a natural thing for people to think about. It's just that the Templars were the warriors. They were the bankers. They were the guarders of the wealth. Of course they must have the Grail. And then stories just grew from there. Roslyn Chapel. This is something in Scotland, and people associate this with the Templars as well. But no, it was built in the 1400s by the Sinclair family. And the Sinclairs liked to claim heritage from things in the past. They liked to claim heritage from the Templars. They liked to, and they also had some Masonic imagery, different things from the stonemason guilds that were going around. Freemasonry, and I could probably do a whole nother talk on Freemasonry, and maybe next year that might be interesting. Some people try to equate Freemasonry going back to the Templars or even earlier. And I don't know, is anyone here a Mason? So when you go to the meetings and they have these little skits, these little plays that are done about Jacques de Molay and the Temple of Solomon, and some of the skits they're taking some liberties with history, and that's also where some of the legends come from. Again, stories that are repeating, that are being repeated, that are not accurate from history. Now, this is something that does have a connection to the Templars. This is the Shroud of Turin. And the Turin was first publicly displayed in 1357. And where did it come from? It came from the family of the grandson of Geoffrey de Charnay, who had been that other Templar who was burned at the stake with Jacques de Molay on that island in the Seine. So there's the shroud, and the family decided to display it. And was it a picture of Jesus? Was it not? There's continuing debate here. I'm not going to say for sure what is fact, what is fiction. However, there has been some carbon dating, and the carbon dating that I know of dates the shroud to 1260 to 1390, which is around the time of the Templars. My favorite theory of what it is because of this symmetry here. So we have the head here, the arms and the legs, the head here and the arms and the legs, is that this was a flag, and this was the top of the flag, and then you had the two sides of it, and it was just a painting of a person that was being carried into battle, and it sort of looked like Jesus. Well, maybe it was painted like Jesus, maybe not, who knows. I don't believe that this was a real shroud, because if you've ever done scientific experiments with this, and say if you paint someone's face with red paint and you put a piece of cloth on their face and then you peel the cloth back, it's not going to look like a face. It's going to look like this big oblong, you know, kind of blob. It's not going to look like this perfectly detailed face. So that's my theory, and I'll move along quickly here. All right. Let me just check how we're doing. So lots of fiction about the Templars. Ivanhoe was really what really started launching a lot of interest in medieval times. We got Da Vinci Code, we got Foucault's Pendulum. Da Vinci Code, I'll go over some of the stuff really quick. They've got at the beginning of his book, he's got everything in the all descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. No, they are not. Street locations where he said, go down the street and you turn right to this museum. I'm like, no, you turn left. I mean, he didn't do his research. He pretended to do research. So the Priory of Sion, according to the Da Vinci Code, according to this book, and I put in italics to say this is just according to the book, there was this organization called the Priory of Sion, founded in 1099, bunch of secret grand masters. The Priory founded the Knights Templar as their military arm, and documents verifying all this were found in a pillar in the French church in the 1800s by a priest named Béranger Saunier. All right. In reality, the Priory of Sion was a hoax that started in 1956. It was started by this guy named Pierre Plantard. Pierre Plantard was someone, he was coming out of World War II here, and he decided that the French government was corrupt and needed to be replaced by a kingdom with him in charge. So he... and he came up with this, and he'd been setting up several different kind of secret organizations, but this is the one that really... It stuck. And he decided to, say, create this thing that was supported with forged documents. And it was really clever how he did this, and it was a hack. And so, right there, hack. I was trying to think, what does Knights Templar have to do with the electronic frontiers track? Very little, but there was a hack. So, okay, there's our link here. Okay. So he planted these documents. One set he planted in the Bibliothèque Nationale, the National Library of France. And the other set, he planted the documents in a book that had been written about a town called Rennes-le-Château in southern France. And Pierre Plantard got one of his associates to write this book about Rennes-le-Château. And in this book about Rennes-le-Château, it said, there are these documents that were written hundreds of years ago that say this and this and this and this. No, the documents were forgeries, and the book was part of the hoax. But it was a clever way to do it. So, if you want to get a real book about the Knights Templar, get a book by Malcolm Barber called The New Knighthood or Trial of the Templars. He is the number one expert in the world on the Knights Templar. He knows his stuff. He's done his research. I've met him. He's a wonderful scholar. Helen Nicholson is also a wonderful scholar. The Knights Templar, A New History. When I was researching the Knights Templar, I would often go into bookstores, and they would usually have tons of books on the Knights Templar. And I'd be going through saying, which of these are good books and which books are not so good? And there were things that I would pull the book off the shelf and I'd flip over to the back of it and I'd scan the back. And there were things that I would see on the back that would immediately make me say no. For example, if there was anything about space aliens on the back of the book, put the book right back on the shelf, okay? If there was anything about the Templars being in charge of the Mongol army, boom, right back on the shelf. If there's anything about Templars conquering Jerusalem in 1300, put right back on the shelf. Now, so this is interesting. This is a painting from Versailles, from the museum, the Versailles Palace in the Hall of the Crusades, where they have these huge, enormous paintings. And this painting is Jacques Molay takes Jerusalem. Jacques de Molay prend Jerusalem, 1299. Beautiful painting. No battle. Never happened. Jacques de Molay wasn't there. He was off on Cyprus. So where did this painting come from? Somebody was saying, oh, yeah, the Templars captured Jerusalem in 1299. I'm like, no, they didn't. And they say, yeah, they did. I'm like, no, they didn't. He said, yeah, go to Versailles. And I went to Versailles, and there's this big painting. Jacques de Molay takes Jerusalem. Where the heck did this painting come from? Well, there were urban legends coming from 1299. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Mongols, another one of my hobbies right now. Because at the end of the Crusades, in the late 1200s, where the Muslims were kind of kicking the Christians out, and the Christians were being pushed back to Europe, and the Mongols were coming in from the east. The Mongols were nasty. They'd get to an area, they believed they had a decree from God that they were going to conquer the world. They'd get to an area, and they'd go to a town, and they'd say, surrender. One time, they would say, surrender. The town surrendered, great, no problem. If the town didn't surrender, Mongols moved in, they killed everyone. Men, women, children, dogs, cats, everyone. So often then the Mongols would get to the next town and they'd say, surrender. The town say, okay. And so the Mongols had been coming in and kind of taking town after town after town. And then the Mongols started butting up against the Muslims. And the first time that the Mongols were defeated, that they didn't come back and avenge the defeat, was actually a battle with the Muslims. It was a battle called the Battle of Ain Jalut on the Sea of Galilee. And that was in 1260 or so. And so the Mongols had come in, and they'd been taking these other northern cities, and then they were defeated, and then they were pushed back, and then that was in 1260. And then 1300, they came in again. And as part of this whole thing, the Mongols were also negotiating with the Christians, saying, can we form an alliance against the Muslims? So to some people, it sort of seems like it makes sense. Okay, Mongols against the Muslim Christians, you know, form it. But it actually wasn't that simple. The Mongols were more of the case of, there were messages that went back and forth. And the messages basically, the Mongols wrote to the Christians and said, submit. And the Christians wrote back and said, convert. And then the Mongols wrote back and said, submit. And the Christians wrote back and said, convert. So, this went on for probably about 50 years or so. But there were some things, and the Mongols started getting a little more tactful, saying, submit, and we'll give you Jerusalem. And so the Europeans kind of liked that idea. They didn't like the submit idea, but they liked the idea of, hey, maybe we'll get Jerusalem. So in 1300, when the Mongols were coming through, and they'd captured these cities, and they'd pushed the Muslims back, and the Muslims had retreated back to Cairo at that point. And so there was this big power vacuum phase. Really, no one was in that area. Well, around the time that the Mongols had defeated these cities over here, some merchants were traveling back to Europe. And the merchants went to Europe and said, the Mongols are doing really well. They've captured Syria. They've captured Damascus. They've captured Aleppo. They must be in Jerusalem by now. And this was in 1300, which was the Jubilee year. So there were huge crowds and a ripe environment for urban legends. And it was like, maybe the Mongols are in Jerusalem. I think the Mongols are in Jerusalem. I heard the Mongols are in Jerusalem. They're going to give Jerusalem back to us. Did you hear? I think the Mongols are in Egypt by now. And these stories kept being repeated. And it wasn't just verbal. People were writing letters. The Pope even released a new papal bull with great rejoicing that Jerusalem has been retaken and is going to be returned to Europe. And they had parades, they were celebrating for about 3 months. And then the truth came in, which is that the Mongols had gotten to about here and then had retreated, and the Muslims had come back in and had retaken the entire area. However, for historians who are researching the time period, it gets very, very difficult to tell what's true and what's false, because you have documents saying the Mongols took Jerusalem. So someone who's not really doing his research is going to see this document and say the Mongols are in Jerusalem. He's going to, oh, Mongols are in Jerusalem. He's going to write a book saying the Mongols captured Jerusalem. And then they're going to tell a painter, and the painter's going to make this huge painting that the Mongols took Jerusalem. Now, how did Jacques de Molay get associated with this big painting? One of the Mongol generals that was coming through here, his name was Mulay, M-U-L-A-Y. Let me see. Yeah, Mulay. Right, and so some historians who are not doing their research are saying Mulay, that must mean Mole. So when it says a Mongol general Mulay was in charge, they thought, oh, that meant Jacques de Molay was in charge of a Mongol division. Jacques de Molay and the Templars were working with the Mongols, and they captured Jerusalem. And so that's how this whole thing kind of gets put together. And then it goes a little further. You end up with this big painting in the Versailles. Jacques de Molay takes Jerusalem, except it didn't really happen. So if you happen to go to France and you happen to see this, you can tell them, I've written to the Versailles, and I have said, you know you got a painting up there that it didn't really happen, and they agreed. They say you're right. We're going to retitle the painting or something, because they understand that it's a fanciful depiction of what people hoped for at the time. So summary. So the Knights Templar organization lasted for about 200 years, 1119 to about 1312, when they were disbanded. They were the world's first multinational corporation, hugely influential in Europe, arrested and persecuted severely starting around October 13, 1307 by Philip IV. Huge impact on modern culture all through England. You know, the Temple Tube Station, Temple Bar, all those things. And it's a compelling legend. It's a fascinating story, and each story keeps building on the next. And so there's a lot of really fun stories out there. Just when you read these books, read them with a grain of salt. And that's it. Thank you very much.
That was short.
Okay.
You got another 45 minutes. What do you want to do?
45 minutes? Any questions? Who has the microphone?
New guy. Oh, you got another 15.
15 minutes, yeah. I'm a professional, yeah. And I'll also be giving 3 other talks at DragonCon tomorrow on famous unsolved codes. I'll be at the Hacking 201 panel on Sunday night, and I'll be speaking about Wikipedia, another one of my favorite hobbies, on Monday at 2:30. Okay. So what was the question? Yeah, are we going to give her a microphone? Or?
Yeah. Come on,
Jerry. Thank you for being patient.
I remember reading an article in Rolling Stone magazine some time ago about this island in, like, Nova Scotia or something. Yeah. Up in that area, the Newfoundland area, where there's just something really mysterious going on. I mean, all the time
you've been tied. Right.
Where the Templars had some.
Right.
Did
that record, or should I repeat the question?
Repeat.
Okay. She was asking about an island in Nova Scotia that has a lot of mysteries associated with it. The name of the island is escaping me at the moment. Does anyone? It's where there's this huge pit that goes down, and there's these barriers of logs, like about every 10 feet or so, and there's, we don't know what's at the bottom of it. There's been a lot of digging that's gone on. And I've actually got a talk on it. Just the name escapes me right now. There's something buried there. I don't think it's associated with the Templars. The Templars were associated, though, with some naval feats. For example, when you think of the ships of Columbus, and their sails had the Templar cross on them. And where did that come from? That was from what I was talking about, how the Knights Templar in Portugal just changed their name over to the Order of Christ. So that Red Cross has been associated with other things as well. There were some wonderful navigators that came from that monastic order as well. The particular pit, I keep thinking the money pit, but I know that there's been a lot of effort, but I don't believe that it has anything to do with Templars. My best guess is that there was some piracy in the area, and that someone was just trying to bury something and then come back to it later. And because the island is it's very, very close to sea level, and so it's very difficult to dig without water flooding in. And several people have actually died trying to get down to the bottom of that. My guess is that if it's ever discovered, that it'll be found that maybe there were a couple chests down there and they've rotted, and so when people have drilled and they've maybe come up with some metal shavings, it might be nails, there might be some coins, but that's my theory about it. Who has the microphone? The microphone's not working. Okay, go ahead.
Why do you think Pope Innocent gave the Templars that deal to begin with, and what do you think happened to the Templar money in other countries besides France?
Okay.
Got disbanded.
Okay, the question was, why did Pope Innocent give them that deal to begin with, and what happened to the money in the other countries? Pope Innocent was interested in supporting the Crusades and in supporting any kind of a military order and getting the troops to the battlefield without having all of their resources kind of taxed away from them as they worked their way down south. And so I believe that was the reason for that order. As to what happened to the funds, most of the Templar resources were transferred over to the Order of the Knights Hospital, and the documents as well. Those were all kept on Cyprus, on the island of Cyprus, and then those records were destroyed about 100, 200 years later when the Turks came in and they took over the island of Cyprus. And I think the money, I don't think that the money was kind of kept as a big treasure. It's very difficult for anyone to hold on to money and not spend it. And so I think that the money kind of came in and a little bit got spent here and a little spent there, and it's all gone at this point.
Well, there was also a number of ransoms, the Egyptian ransoms.
During the Crusades, there was which king was it that went down? I think it was during the Fifth Crusade. And he was trying to attack Damietta in Egypt. And the battle didn't go so well, and he was arrested and by the Muslims and captured and then ransomed. And the ransom came from a loan from the Templars. So. Okay. Next question. Purple here.
From the way you were presented up until the time of King Philip, the Knights Templar were very powerful, very well thought of. But hadn't really done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
With that much power, it seems to me almost natural that there would be some sort of corruption happening, or that some people would have legitimate rights against them.
Mm-hmm. The statement was that with the Templars being a powerful organization, anyone with that much power, there's probably going to be some resentment and possibly some actual corruption. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that there were people that were resentful, especially when they owed money to the Templars. They were resentful. And there were stories of occasional corruption. But the largest complaints were usually, again, this dichotomy of monks should not be warriors. They should not be fighting. That was one of the main criticisms that was leveled at them. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. In the back. Yeah.
I was wondering, what kind of sources do you use in your study? Are there a lot of sources or not?
The question is, what kind of sources do I use? I use as many sources as I can get my hands on. Some people, when they do research, they get like one history book and they read all the way through it, and then another and they read all the way through it. I tend to get like about 15 books, and then I spread them all around me and I pick one fact that I want to research, and I look up that one fact in each one of the 15 books, and there'll usually be many, many different stories in each of the books. And then I try and figure out, like, you know, what's the consensus, which doesn't mean it's going to be majority rules. So if it was majority rules, we'd be talking space aliens up here. Okay, but I ask around at St. Louis University, where there's Crusades historians that meet. I talk to various, for example, Dr. Thomas Madden, who's a well-known researcher about the Crusades. He was on TV a lot after the September 11th attacks, because there were questions about, were the September 11th attacks, were they a something that had its roots in the Crusades about the disagreements between the Muslims and the Christians. And there is some story for that about the battle. There's many Muslims today who are still resentful about the Crusades. It's not old history to them. It's something that's very active. But in terms of good sources, Dr. Malcolm Barber is the number one I recommend. And look for books that have citations in them that say what their sources are, as opposed to just someone writing from the top of their head. Look for books that are recommended by other books that are reviewed well. Those would be my top things. When I was arguing on Wikipedia with some people about whether or not the Mongols, one guy, he came up with this theory that that Jacques de Molay had personally signed a treaty with the Mongols. And he pointed at this history book by a man named Laurent Dallier. And I went to the Library of Congress. I mean, this book was not common. I went to the Library of Congress to track down this book, and sure enough, Laurent Dallier had said Jacques de Molay signed a treaty with the Mongols. No citations, no sources, no indication where it came from. And I looked at Dallier's other books, no mention of a treaty. So sometimes historians just make mistakes. You know, sometimes they read something wrong, and sometimes they screw up. And so then you read the second edition of the book, and they go, oops, sorry, here's the 20 things that I got wrong in the first book. So it's important to get back up, to get especially what's called peer review, to have a book and then have another historian who knows that subject read the book and say, was this a good book or not a good book? Okay, next question. Over by the wall. I can't hear you.
Money was controlled by the church.
Good question. Money lending, the question is, money lending was considered evil by the church, especially the idea of money lending and charging interest. And that was a problem with the Templars. So they... I can't answer the question completely. I can say that there were some interesting things that were going on with charging rent on land and whatnot, but it was the church closed its eyes to a lot of things that the Templars did or actively encouraged them because the ultimate goal was good, which was of protecting the Holy Land, of maintaining control of Jerusalem, of protecting the pilgrims that were on their way down there. And St. Bernard and others were arguing that there were rules that could be set aside towards this project of getting Jerusalem back, which was the ultimate goal. The question is about these books that are stacked up in front of me. Yes, I have. I am an author. I've written a book called The Mammoth Book of Secret Codes and Cryptograms. It has nothing to do with the Templars whatsoever. However, I'm proud to say my book is now in its fourth printing, so I'm very happy about that. And these are third printing books, and so often people want to come up and buy a book. So if anyone, I'm not pushing them. Since you asked, yes, I have books available. Okay. Any other way in the back?
I know the Knights Templar have a substantial amount of rituals for initiation among many others.
Mm-hmm.
Through your research, what have you found that space alien ties to previous organizations that they mimic similar rituals in organizations that were before the Knights Templar?
Okay, so the question was about the initiation rituals of the Knights Templar and what did they mirror from earlier organizations. The only organization that I know of that they really mimicked was the Cistercian Order from St. Bernard. There are some rituals today with the Freemasons who claim that they are reproducing some rituals from the Knights Templar. I don't believe that's true. The Freemasons started in the early 1700s, and it kind of rose up out of these, it evolved very slowly. There were these stonemason guilds that were earlier, and then there were these gentlemen clubs that started in the early 1700s, which were where people who wanted to discuss ideas freely away from the church would kind of gather. And then that's kind of where Freemasonry came from. And then Freemasonry decided that they wanted to kind of enhance their own image and say that they were spiritual successors of earlier organizations such as the Knights Templar. And then as more time went on, that it kind of blurred the idea of, well, you know, the Templars ended in 1300 and the Masons didn't really start up until the early 1700s. But these days people just go, oh, well, it happened a long time ago, and they kind of blur it all together. The Freemasons also try and have some say that they have some rituals that go back all the way time to the first Temple of Solomon, you know, thousands of years old. I've never seen any documents which have shown rituals from the times of the Temple of Solomon. So I think a lot of it is kind of made up and then is said as a they keep saying it's a tradition and eventually it becomes a tradition, but the origins really aren't as solid as they claim. Does that kind of...
It kind of explains the transition from the Knights Templar to the Freemasons, but I was looking for more, if you had found any evidence like parallelisms or predecessors for the Knights Templar.
The only predecessor that I personally know of is like I said, St. Bernard's Cistercian Order. I mean, it was a monastic order, and monks definitely had their rituals and prayers and things going back, you know, thousands of years to the time of Christ. But it's not something I've read up a lot about. So I'm sorry, I can't give more info on that. Okay, here.
Did Dan Brown get anything right?
The question was, did Dan Brown get anything right? It's a great story. It's a great page. I mean, it's a fun read if you just want a fun story to read. And yes, I mean, the Vatican exists, and I mean, with angels and demons, you know, and yes, cardinals do go into conclave, and yes, there's a painting called the Mona Lisa, which is really famous, and he's done some fun things with codes, because his background, I wrote his biography on Wikipedia as well, and his father's a mathematician who actually wrote a major mathematics textbook that's used in school. And when Dan Brown was a kid, his parents would do these treasure hunts for him, where they would like hide things around the house, and you'd find something, and there'd be a secret message that would send you someplace else where you'd see a secret message. And so that kind of worked its way into his books, because that's often each of his books tends to follow the same kind of a path. You go here, you get a clue. You go here, you get a clue. And he's done some fun things with that. Like, I'll talk about this in my codes talk, but in the artwork of the book jacket of Da Vinci Code, there's five puzzles that are hidden in the artwork. And these puzzles give clues to the subject of his next book, which is a fun thing that he did. Two of the puzzles refer to the sculpture at the center of CIA headquarters called Kryptos. He did this at the end of his book, I think it was Digital Fortress. I think he had a secret message at the end of that book as well, I think it decodes to the Da Vinci Code will surface or something like that.
To the point where I was reading one chapter, going to Wikipedia.
Well, Wikipedia also needs to be taken with a grain of salt. We're actually talking about maybe doing some, I've heard people talk about color coding pages. You can look at a page and see what has changed within the last 24 to 48 hours, so you know that maybe somebody has slid something. I mean, people will come in and they'll like just change a birth year by a couple of years just to screw with the article. And it's a constant arms race. But that's a whole other talk that I'm going to be giving. Dan Brown, I think the major thing that I like is that because he wrote about this stuff and he made it interesting and exciting and sexy, and it made people want to learn more about these subjects. So one of the reasons I learned more about the Knights Templar is because I was reading Da Vinci Code and going, is that, I don't think that's true, and I went and researched it. I would say he got it right in there. He's increased people asking questions and learning, and that's always a good thing. Oh, it's open to lots and lots of interpretations. The historians will say it was two knights on a single horse, emphasizing poverty. That's it. However, it's used as a banner by gay organizations who want to say that the Knights Templar were gay, and that's what they were trying to say, is two knights on a single horse. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's about poverty, and that was also a great way as a charity. It's like, you know, if you have that moving truck comes by that says starving students, I mean, people are going to be more likely to give a big tip to the movers, because people like to give money to whoever they think is poor. But eventually the Templars weren't so poor, but people kept giving a lot of money. It was great, great branding to have two knights on a single horse. Yeah. Any other questions? I see way in the back.
Do you know of any credible sources about the religious practices of the Knights Templar? I know there's like all kinds of speculations that, you know, through all the stuff that they worshipped John the Baptist, that they were Gnostics and very dogs with Sophia. Is there anything really credible out there?
No, the Knights Templar were Christian. They were Christian. They believed in Jesus Christ. They answered to the Pope. There were lots of stories told about them from people that were resentful at the time, and there's also stories today written by people who just aren't really doing their research and are seeing these terms Baphomet. During the trial, I mean, King Philip really muddied the waters because he threw all these false charges at the Templars. He said that they were worshiping false idols, that they were urinating on the cross, that they were not good Christians. And this was at the time of the Templars he was saying these things. So there was a lot of confusion even then. But everything I've seen says no, they were very, very devout Christians.
Was the goal of the Knights Templar to keep pilgrims safe as they were going to Jerusalem? When pilgrims were no longer able to go to Jerusalem because the Muslims had taken it back, then did their goal become that to help retake Jerusalem?
Okay, so the question was, what happened when the Templars' original goal was to protect the pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem, but then Jerusalem was retaken, so what was the Templars' goal at that point? And that's a good question. That was actually one of the controversies that was going on in Europe. What are the Templars for? And they continued, they were very strong warriors, and they were very sought after in the battles. This was over a couple hundred years. Only about 10% of the Templars were actual warriors. About 90% of the order were administrative bankers and managing the huge infrastructure that dealt with the Templars. And also, even after the Muslims took Jerusalem, pilgrims were still going there. There were agreements with the Muslims because the Muslims acknowledged that there were important religious sites there. So they gave permission for some people to manage, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and to allow Christians to come in on some of the holy days. So there were still travelers as well. Any other questions?
One more.
Well, besides... I will answer this question. Did anyone else have a question? Okay, I think we're good. If you want to come up, we can talk.
how did you mention in the battles the Knights Templar were very fearless warriors.
Mm-hmm.
They would charge into the center of the enemy and they
mm-hmm.
took massive casualties.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get replaced?
More and more people kept joining from Europe. This was over hundreds of years, so it was like a corporation. New people were joining all the time. New people were dying all the time. Any army is constantly going to have new people coming in. Ah, sorry.
Wasn't Philip the fair fighting the 100-year war with the English, and that's why he needed the money to keep himself going?
Question was whether King Philip IV was fighting the 100-year war with the English. I know he was fighting the English. I don't know if that was the 100 Years' War. You may be right.
It's around that right time.
Okay. There we have it. He says it's around the right time. I'm going to look that up. That's a good question. That would be a good factoid here. Okay. All right. Thank you.